Well, it should be pretty clear by now that in these talks, we're looking at the simplest principles about healing. It says, if we know nothing, and probably all of us are beginners when it comes to healing work. And in a curious way, probably all of us are also patients, because in one way or another, we all need prayers. Even Max Heindel, after several initiations which indicate a very high degree of human development, had serious illnesses. And by his own admission, he had besetting sins. He has very interesting things, curious things to say about illness and healing. And he seems to imply that illness and healing mean something different for spiritual aspirants than they do for regular everyday people. At least it's different in degree. In all cases, whether one is an aspirant or not an aspirant, illnesses are meant to correct bad attitudes in thought, in emotion, and in deed. We have bad attitudes. Now, in ordinary, non-aspiring people, at least not aspiring to initiation, illnesses come when destiny is ripe and when the individual is strong enough for that to happen. And both of those conditions, the ripeness and the strength of the patient, are done or worked out in harmony with the recording angels, who keep track of all of destiny and how it comes ripe and when the best things can be brought out at the best moment. As aspirants or candidates for initiation, one is supposedly putting much more into life and living life more intensely and trying to go beyond the pace of things as it is right now. The pace of things right now is pretty slow. And as a consequence of this intensity, it hastens the ripening process, so that things come up or are intentionally brought up with the aid of a teacher that would not normally be experienced except for lives in the future. Therefore, for an aspirant to initiation, illness is an indication of success. So to be seriously ill or to be often ill is a mark that you're successful in your spiritual life. Now, of course, we try to live a healthy life, and we try not to dwell on illness when it comes, and we don't want to linger in it, but when it comes, we try to get the most of it. Now, in the Christian mysteries, initiation often accompanies serious illness. The example is given in the Rosicrucian teachings of Johann Wolfgang Goethe, the great poet, that he raised his level of consciousness during a period of severe illness, which was at initiation or something like an initiation. And we can check this out, and it is a biographical fact that there was a pronounced period of severe illness in his life, and it was in that time of his life that he became interested and had an insatiable curiosity about spiritual things and things of the mysteries. Now, there are several reasons why Christian mysticism has these attitudes about healing or about illness in the case of an initiate. One of them is to harvest soul material. In order to leave our body, it's always a close nip and tuck situation whether a person can do it or not. And every last little bit of soul material that one has is important. So if there is an illness or something like that, and we are reaping the soul material from our past experiences, that might be enough to put us over the edge. Because initiation, in this sense, is an initiation into the ability to do magic, healing included. And so, in order to do that, it isn't just a matter of thinking something, it is a matter of thinking something and having the soul power. So the amount of soul power which one has is important. Another factor is humbling. Because the lower nature doesn't give up just because you're ready for initiation, it still has to be tamed. Hopefully lovingly tamed. And it still has strength and it can do its most to keep the true self from coming into command as it must in initiation by putting up egoism. And egoism and egocentricity and pride and all of those sorts of things are very detrimental. And they're very much of a block to spiritual growth. Another factor is compassion. When we're ill and when we suffer, on one hand, we're aware of ourselves and the mistakes we make, but we're also aware of suffering in general. And that promotes compassion in us. It also opens us to see the world in a very different way. Now, when a candidate for initiation has an illness, it is treated or regarded in a very different way than for the person on the street. The person on the street is given healing and help to make the attitude changes that need to be made as quickly as possible. For the candidate for initiation, illness is almost itself healing. In the Christian initiation, one is loved. One is loved by a teacher or teachers, and love is poured on them, and that calls forth something from the candidate in order to be initiated. I believe that words that Max Heindel uses is when somebody is facing as much of their past destiny as they are psychologically and physically capable of facing, the words are given to them, "If thou be Christ, help thyself." Meaning to say that the candidate has to begin to live a divine life. Because as an initiate, one is consciously entering in a very small way to a life of divinity. Not just a holy life, but a creative life. And so this is a very important thing. In this regard, illness is seen as a part of becoming self-conscious and of becoming self-willed and making transitions in consciousness. The ancient Manichaeans, who were Persian mystics about the 5th century AD, Max Heindel tells us that later they became a school of greater mysteries. But if one was a candidate in the Manichaean school and one had an illness, they understood that they were making a transition from one state of being to another state of being, and it was up to them to, with their consciousness, make that transition. And either they did or they didn't. There was no treatment of illness. The candidate was left to his or herself to make the transition. And if the transition was a transition that we call death, so what? That's what comes of it. Leaving the body consciously is actually even called the little death, because it is facing death and going to the other side of death when you first leave your body. Now that view is a little bit harsh and extreme. The modern mystery schools are not that strong, but they are somewhat in that direction. Now this is abhorrent to a lot of people. They would think that the spiritual life you should never be ill on, being completely unaware of what a large backlog of log of destiny we have from past lives and the kinds of things that lurk within us in our personal unconscious. It makes sense to me because we pray every day to love more, and we pray every day to serve better. And we pray for whatever it takes for us to learn to love and serve better. And if the answer to our prayers is an illness, we don't turn around and say, take it away from me, take it away from me, because this is what we've been looking for right away. We don't want to become some kind of spiritual masochists and wallow in suffering, but when it comes, we take it and we use it as an experience to wring as much soul material as we can out of it. And that's another form of living intensely, when we're living to the fullest. For us, an illness is an experience. It is a heightened experience, and we try to live that as intensely as possible. I guess I should just continue this kind of ranting and continue on this wandering path, talking about different thoughts with no particular organization. We're doing something new when talking about healing. This is the first time I ever spent much time talking about healing. And when we do that, we have been having to define words along the way. That's just so that we're clear about what we say. Being a Virgo, I like defining words and I like giving names. I've always wanted to give a name to a flower, and I've always wanted to give a name to a racehorse. And I've never been in a position to do either. If we don't clarify our definitions of what we're talking about, we'll be in some kind of a babble and we won't be able to understand it all. So let's clarify one more word. And in this case, the word has two meanings. And the two meanings fit together with serendipitous beauty. And I don't know whether that is somehow by divine intention or whether that is a coincidence that came along the way, a meaningless coincidence. It might just be due to the spiritual genius that is inside of any language. And I say this even after having studied the etymologies of the two meanings or the two definitions of the same word. I looked them up in Webster's Unabridged, and I tried to follow them as much as I could, and it isn't clear that they come from the same source. We are told in the cosmic conception to believe all things, but yet at the same time, in the title page of the very first cosmic conception, is the quote from Paul, to prove all things. The two aren't contradictory to each other. But we have to be a little careful, because sometimes we're likely to believe things because we want to believe them. And I don't want to be guilty of that. We can even misread or we can misperceive things because it would fit our ideas very well. And that almost puts us in a place like the literalist fundamentalist who says something to the effect, if English was good enough for Jesus, it's good enough for me. There are people that think that way. They think that the Bible was written in English and that the words mean exactly what their doctrines say they mean. In this case, it is uncertain. It's not certain at all that the two different meanings come from the same source. The word is sound. In one usage, we have something that comes from the Rosicrucian motto: a sane mind, a soft heart, and a sound body. In the other usage, we have, for example, we say, that sounds true to me. Now, the etymologies aren't clear because there isn't one common word in either Sanskrit and not even in Zen to... we have this continuous joke going on. Sharaji thinks that everything goes back to Sanskrit, and I tell him that everything goes back to Zen, and he disagrees with all of that. While there is doubt about the etymology of it, about a common source, there is no doubt about both usages when it comes to health and healing. Now, in trying to get at this topic and understand it, we have to be very fundamental. And we have to remember the unity of all things. The universe is a unity. There is no other. It's one. It's a unified whole. It shares the common being. It is within one universal spirit. And everything else is within that one. So when we talk about things like spirit and matter, or actual and potential, or subjective and objective, all of those things are within one. We don't want to give the idea, because we've talked a lot about spirit and matter, that we have a pure dualism and that the two are two separate things never to meet. Prior to creation and after creation, everything is in that singular unity in a pure, undifferentiated manner. All differentiation, all manifestation, all objectification are within the one. We have a physical analogy in a hen's egg. If we see a chick come out of an egg and then remember what that egg was like first, we see that the claws and the feathers and the flesh all came from one single cell. That is reminiscent. Whether we talk about it in the folk sense of the goose that laid the golden egg, or whether we talk about it as the ancient creation myth that comes from India, where they talk about the black swan laying an egg of light, we're talking about a unity of that type. Now, in perfect unity, objectification produces dualism immediately. Even if we objectify one point in a completely homogeneous universe, we have a dualism. We have this one location and everything else. And those are the two parts of the dualism. Now, it's way beyond the scope of this talk to talk about that, though I would like to do that. But usually, because spirit is one, the two states of spirit that are more spiritual or more material are more symmetric than that. It is as if we mentioned yesterday in the talk that the more one materializes something or differentiates something, the more there has to be a deeper spirituality to match that deeper differentiation and to hold it into being. It is because of that unity those two differentiations meet. So spirit and matter are born together, and they reflect each other, and they are two parts of consciousness that is waking. Actually, it's all one continuum. And where spirit and matter meet is what could be called the center of being, the center of that spirit-matter pole. So that if we proceed one way from the center of being, things become more abstract. They become more universal in their character. They become more inward. If you proceed the other direction from that common center, things become more concrete. They become more form-oriented. They become more particular, and they become more outward. The spirit side is more directive, and it is more wakingly conscious. The matter side is more receptive, or even resistantly receptive, and the meaning is in form and not in waking consciousness. In our solar cosmos and in our human constitution, which is all our vehicles of consciousness and being, because we are a product and we are a miniature of the solar system, we are inseparable from it. We don't make things outside of creation, we make them within the creation. They're of the same stuff as the creation itself. So we are a first fruits. Now the center of either the solar system or the center of our being is at the heart of the world of thought. In the human constitution, it is in the very heart of the mind, as deep as we can penetrate into the concrete mind. In Rosicrucian terminology, this region of concrete thought is called the region of archetypes. And this usage of archetypes is like the usage of archetypes has been in all of the Western mysteries. Carl Jung uses the word archetype as something abstract. He says it is like Platonic ideas. And I wish he would have used the term Platonic ideas and not archetypes, because he's caused a lot of confusion in the world. Everything that is conceived and carried out in spirit is projected or becomes manifest in concrete existence by first becoming a concrete thought. And the most basic, the most archetypal of all concrete thoughts are those that come from the center of the mind. And this center of the mind is the part that is closest to the spirit. And this is what is meant when it is said that Mercury was the servant of the gods, and that Mercury was closest to all of the gods, and in a kind of neutrality, as there is a neutrality when you're right between spirit and matter, Mercury served everyone. Now, spiritual investigators, such as the Elder Brothers of the Rosicrucian Order, claim that this region especially, and all of the regions of concrete thought, the attribute of it is tone or pitch. The ability to read thoughts in the region of concrete thoughts is called tonal vision. It's not quite like hearing with our ears. It is hearing with our mind. One hears the truth, so to speak. And if you'll notice how you learned grammar and how you work out grammar in yourself, is you hear it into existence at the same time that you're logically thinking it into existence. It sounds true. So the concrete mind is both a live creative organ and a very receptive instrument at the same time. People who are trained and learn how to precisely use the mind hear tones. They hear the tones of archetypes, some of which are melded together, or I don't know how you say it, are overlapped with other tones or pitches to become quite complex archetypes. Like there is a complex archetype of the everything in the of the continents of the world. So every thought that has gone into the formation of the continents of the world is there. So there's an amazing thought to try and think and hold out. So because everything is so deeply concentrated and everything is so close to the spirit, when one apperceives in the world of concrete thought, apperceiving an archetype for a fraction of a second, you can understand something that takes thousands or even millions of years to be worked out. Something that is very complicated. You think and you know as whole as one can think and know in anything concrete. There have been people, and not all of them, that have been initiates that have developed this ability. The most famous of them is Wolfgang Mozart. He could hear, in a fraction of a second, a symphony, an entire symphony, and then he would have to take that entire symphony and break it down, and because the thought is so much of a whole, it isn't delineated. So he would have to find a way to delineate it. And he actually even wrote things like the Dice Symphony. And he used the throwing of dice in order to find a pathway to unwind the symphony. And he actually did this. And there would be concerts, and there would be lords and ladies in fancy attire, and he'd get out the dice cup and have them shake the dice cup. And after a few throws, that set up a pattern, and then the pattern was given to the conductor, and that would be the pattern that the music was unfolded through. We know that pitch, even in this world, is involved with both creation and destruction. There is a famous film with the New York Camera Club. It's old now. It must be from somewhere back in the 20s, I believe, that this woman developed an ability to project sound onto oil colors floating on water. And she would say, "Now I'm going to make a four-leaf clover." And she would project sound through a speaker into that device. A later rebirth of that device was called an idophone. And then she would produce a very colorful four-leaf clover. Other people couldn't do it, but she could do it. And the most of the figures that she created were polar coordinates, if you know what those are. That's not the, not using the Cartesian coordinates, but you use one pole and a radius. And another example we have of the destructive power of sound was from Ella Fitzgerald. Remember the thing where she would sing a tone and she would smash a glass, and they made they would make an ad for some kind of tape, recording tape with that. All right. So Mozart wrote symphonies sometimes in a fraction of a second. Some of them were his own creations, and some of them were just writing down what he heard from the music of the spheres. Because, like people who have this ability to penetrate with their mind, he had a phenomenal memory. He heard a secret mass one time, and he went home and he scored it, and it was no longer a secret mass after that. What we're talking about here, when Mozart or somebody like that can hear the sounds of thought forms, we're talking about the music of the spheres. Now, because the music of the spheres can be limited in such a way that we can play it by a symphony in a concert hall, it doesn't mean that the cosmos is a gigantic concert hall. The various divine beings, who were certainly not the only ones that are doing the thinking, the various divine beings that are associated with the planets and the signs and the constellations are doing their work. It is a glorious work, and it is their work that actually makes the creation happen. So everything that is manifest through these archetypes, and they are created like music. So the manifest cosmos is created, transformed, sustained, and dissolved through the music of the spheres. The divine beings are thinking. They don't think quite exactly the same way we think, but they're thinking, and it's the same world of thought. We now have a concrete mind, and it is the instrument of our self, of our divine being. And this qualifies us as creators. Our creations are pretty insignificant at this point. But you got to start somewhere. You know, you're not masterful right away. In fact, we are journeyman creators. And so our relationship to the music of the spheres is a very special relationship. Now, we know that in any form of elementary education, the elementary education is ruled by Gemini. And Gemini is where you mimic something else. I can remember learning how to think by first contorting my consciousness to a friend of mine who I could see was a very excellent thinker, and I tried to think as he thought. And it was plagiarism. There's nothing wrong with plagiarism. Nobody owns the universe. Nobody owns a thought. You may have been the originator of it, but that might be as embarrassing as it is wonderful. And eventually I got my own voice and I learned how to talk. This is what we are doing relative to the music of the spheres. For us, the music of the spheres is not comprised of archetypes. It is archetypal. The divine beings that are associated with the signs and the planets are of such a high order that their thinking is true. They have more than perfect pitch. They have perfect creative pitch. And so what we do in our thinking is we are learning perfectly, but usually more often imperfectly, to think according to the way the gods think, by thinking using standards that come from the music of the spheres. Now, because we're imperfect, our thinking is imperfect. And then we made this egregious mistake of working adharmoniously to the whole process. And because of this, we're out of tune. And we're seriously out of tune. All illness is because of one of these two factors. Because we are imperfect thinkers, or because we are deviant and perverted thinkers. If we want to be healed, if we want to be healthy, if we want to be healers, we have to learn how to think truly. And we have to become more true in our thoughts as we progress. Anytime we get ill, it's like pointing the finger at ourselves saying, you have been untrue in your thinking. We must think clearly. We must think in harmony with the cosmic standards. We must think true to that. And we must think in a pro-evolutionary manner, so that we are in our character in harmony with the whole creation. Because if we're out of harmony with the whole creation, we can't do anything but be ill. Now, before we proceed forward, we have to make a correction, because otherwise what we're doing is going too much in a level that we're narrow about things. There's another side to it. We want to be as rich as we can with this in a very short talk. The Rosicrucian philosophy teaches that in a literal way, there is a Hosanna chorus. Somebody just made a joke about that earlier. That there is truly a Hosanna chorus, and that it is a glorious chorus of angels and other divine beings. Actually, they are the same thing as the music of the spheres. People who report hearing the music of the spheres with tonal vision say that the archetypes sing themselves to you. And Mozart was once asked, what is his favorite instrument? And he says, there is only one instrument, and that is the voice. And that is true. So it is the word, the grand word from which all creation comes, is sung out by the divinities as a chorus. And you can't stop singing, because if you did, everything would dissolve. So one way of looking at it is that we're looking at something like a symphony, the way a symphony is put together. It's not something that's mechanical. It's something that is sung. Everything is sung into existence. Each being sings its thoughts into the cosmos. Now, the words of the song are not artificial like our words. They are words that are more words of power. They have character, just like our words carry character with them, but they are words of power that are in and of the stuff that the creation is made of itself. All of our thoughts are imbued with character. And all of our thoughts express that character in an attitude. So in this regard, the mind is not completely neutral. There are attitudes. Character is a quality of the spirit. It's a quality of the spirit that has been acquired through creative experience. By going through creative experience, by interacting with the cosmos, the essence of our interactions return to the Creator, and the Creator in spirit then has character. According to the way that character is to be expressed, it is done by attitude. Attitude is something that is under our control. Character is so much part of us that it can't be separated from us. But we can manifest intentionally different parts of character through different attitudes. Now, from all of this, it's pretty clear that this is a top-down perspective that we talked about in an earlier talk. We said that if someone thinks true and accurate thoughts and does good thinking with good attitudes, they will eventually be healthy. For most of us, that's going to take a while, no matter how hard we work at it. And it is the duty of every spiritual student to spend some time every day to practice thinking, deep concentration, to attune ourselves to the truth of something so that we are at one with it, so that our spirit is brought in unity with some part of the creation. So when we have somebody like a master healer or something like that, the healing process, if a miraculous healing is accomplished by beginning first with thought. The healed individual not only receives that thought, but the healed individual changes his or her mind. And that's important, because if there's no change, there's no use in trying to heal a person, because they're just going to go back to the way they were before. This is, again, the top-down thing, that the character has to change, that there has to be something that comes from this. We're going to talk in succeeding days in detail about some of these things, but this is where we are with it right now. Now, because a patient can resonate with the healer long enough to begin to change an attitude in self, that doesn't mean they're going to be able to stay there all the time. But in the liaison, in the interaction between agent and patient, there is a communion that is sustained long enough for the patient to change the patient's mind and begin the top-down healing process. When this is so, it is then up to the patient to do the best that he or she can to sustain that new attitude. And after the relief from a serious illness, most people really do try to sustain that attitude. But this is why in many, many of the healings of Christ Jesus, after the healing, the patient is told, go and sin no more. Don't revert to your own ways. Healing is like that. It doesn't just take away a negative. It doesn't take away an illness. That's not what the process of healing is. It transforms the application of the principle that has been misused to cause the illness into a positive application, so that a person has a new positive attitude. In this regard, healing the sick is the same thing as preaching the gospel. In these talks, we've been looking dualistically And we've been looking at dualism within the fundamental unity from the beginning of creation. Now, in this, it is as we must expect. This must be true to all of the bodies. It can't be that the mind alone vibrates to truth or is an expression of truth. All of the other bodies must be also. So let's think about this a little bit. We have music as an analogy. Now there are two ways that we can be out of tune, that we can be off pitch or off key. One can be either flat or one can be sharp. One can be too slow and low, or one can be too fast and high. This, Max Heindel tells us, is extremely important to healing, not only in the mind, but in all of the other bodies. Because all of the other bodies can either be flat or sharp, and thus out of tune. It's possible for one body to be more in tune than another. There are a lot of curious things we can do with ourselves. But we're talking primarily about healing in the physical body, because this is where we're suffering the most now, and this is where we are in the greatest ignorance. So if this is true, we would expect to find this sharpness and flatness in the dense physical body. And this we surely do. We find it from individual cells and organisms to the entire metabolism. The physical organism seeks stability, and it does so by maintaining a balance. The balance is manifold, but it has one common name, and that one common name is homeostasis. There are many homeostatic balances in the body. Sodium, potassium, sugar, insulin, oxygen, carbon dioxide, temperature high or low, spinal fluid pressure, blood pressure high or low, they're all like that. There are balances between organs. There are balances between glands, especially endocrine glands. And there are balances between systems. Some people put way too much in the nervous system and not enough in the circulatory system. And this produces an imbalance, so that the general of the body is either sharp or flat. So there are only two ways a homeostatic balance can be upset, and they're the same two ways. And we have words for them that run throughout all medical and physiological terminology. If one is flat or slow or underactive, we say it is hypoactive. If one is fast or sharp or overactive, we say it is hyperactive. So from this, it's pretty plain to see that disturbances in the balance of the body come from hypoactivity or hyperactivity, and it originates from various organs or glands, or sometimes even from small groups of cells. So what the Rosicrucian philosophy says is clearly true physiologically. Max Heindel goes so far as to say that in terms of medicine, and when he talks about medicine, he explicitly and exclusively talks about the use of herbs. He says the intent is that by means of medicine is to establish a balance so that one can be in tune with the cosmic balance as much as is possible within one's archetype. It's also clear that medicine is not meant to be a continual activity. It is meant to be a temporary measure, sort of like if you're balancing and walking on a tightrope, and you're starting to fall, it's as if the medicine gives you a little bit of stability for a second so that you can regain your balance. And then you can continue forward on your own. So it's clear that medicine is only a stopgap measure. And it is only temporary until the individual can get their balance back again. This means, without a doubt, that the individual can change his or her habits or attitudes and institute something that's more permanent. It always happens. We make mistakes. We have conditions that are very uncomfortable in our body, and we look around for ways to straighten it out, and we don't even notice it often. We look for remedies, physical remedies, and some of them work, but at the same time, we change our attitude about things. I have a tendency to be very narrow-minded. And very often, healing for me has to do with, I'm humiliated and I am brought to do things that I said I would never, ever do. And in that humiliation, my narrow-mindedness is given a little shove to reach a balance in a different way. Each of the systems or organs, or parts, or cells, or tissues in our body is the manifestation of a living cosmic hierarchy. And the way those hierarchies function in consciousness is reflected in the structure and the way the different organs and such work in the body. So by pondering an accurate horoscope, one can determine in a simple way how the native, the person behind that horoscope, is addressing creative principles. Some things are pretty simple and obvious, and the attitude and the condition are fairly easy to see, though they may not be easy to change. Some are deeply ingrained in our character because we've had bad habits for a long time. Other things are much more subtle, much more difficult. But they aren't something that can't be solved because we created them in the first place. And we should be able to undo and redo what we did. If we can't do that, there's no sense in the whole cosmos. Astrodiagnosis, to be able to tell every little thing, is the most difficult part of astrology that I've ever encountered. And I've been studying astrology since 1963. I'll let you do the arithmetic. However, if we have a patience, and if we have a will, and if we start listening, and if we start listening for intuition, anybody should be able to work with their own horoscope and understand the underlying attitudes that need to be changed. But the axe is laid to the root. You have to be very fundamental about it, because thoughts are almost like those flies that come around and bother you. No matter what you do, you can't get rid of them. And you have to, in order to change your mind, to significantly change your mind, it takes work. And you have to really want to change your mind. This is a very important thing to healing. In my own case, I find that I use my mind too much, and I use it too much in a wrong way. And if I'm too busy with the busy work of the mind, I am not listening for intuition. So even something that is a good quality can be abused. We have to look at the spiritual side behind the archetypes, and we have to be listening for that intuition of truth and not just be mentally busy. The important thing about all of this is that thinking is fundamental to ultimate health and healing. And sometimes it's subtle and complex and very stubborn, and sometimes it's simple. Sometimes an organ is hyperactive, and sometimes it's hypoactive. And this is this is one of those things. It's a back and forth kind of thing. If we look, somebody might have a hyperactive organ, maybe an endocrine organ, but it may be substituting for the real culprit, which is hypoactive. Maybe you're using the thyroid to substitute for the suprarenals, and you're stimulating yourself with thyroid instead of with adrenaline, or it could be the other way around. And if you try to cure a hypoactive thyroid without getting to the hypoactive suprarenals, you know, it's, you know, like levels on levels like that. I can't tell you that that healing or astrodiagnosis is always going to be simple. And for us, it's, you know, we're not like people on the street that leave it up to experts. Each one of us is trying to become a spiritual healer, so it's up to us to learn these things, to figure it out for ourselves. And, you know, so we have to go through all of those chains of subtleties. Now, the Rosicrucian philosophy does not deny the germ theory as a cause of illness. But it says that it is a later cause and not a primary cause. Thinking is the initial cause, and something like a bacterium is a terminal cause. It's because we've thought a certain way and acted a certain way and eaten a certain way, we produce conditions in our body that are just perfect for that bacterium to live in. But if you get rid of the bacterium and you don't change the thinking, you're doing a disservice to yourself. So that the Rosicrucian philosophy, it's not anti-drug, but it's certainly not drug happy with regard to curing conditions. Now, it must be clear that we have a lot of attitude problems. This is especially important because the concrete mind, which does not only deliberative thinking, it does cunning thinking. It is in cahoots with the lower nature in the desire world. And it is a false ego, and it would just as soon have false notions just to keep its own power. So we all have that kind of cunning in us. And as a result of this cunning, as a result of putting the mind in the service of the lower nature, it has made all of humanity flat. It has slowed us down, and it has brought our consciousness more deeply into matter than was intended. It has brought us so deeply into matter that we have lost conscious recognition of the spiritual worlds. A superficial reading of the Bible tells us very clearly, whether we're reading the Garden of Eden story or whether we're reading St. Paul saying that we could see to the very Godhead itself before we chose to live on the husks of matter, that it's very clear that we have intentionally put ourselves in a deviate path that is flat, and that we are, because of that, we're too materialistic. So we have a hypo-spirituality and a hyper-materialism. So we have fallen in pitch. Fortunately, something that is from well on the other side of the concrete mind is afforded to us, and that is grace. Grace is a manifestation of the original primordial word, of which all of the other things are subsets. They're like scales or modes or something of that nature within the original creative word. And that original creative word is a word of love. And like all good balancing things, it can give just exactly the balance that is needed. Therefore, the acceptance of what is called in Orthodox Christianity the grace of Christ into our lives causes us to see the world differently. There is an immediate change in consciousness of someone such that attitudes that we have struggled with or maybe even reveled in, because sometimes we can be very impertinent and sassy in our pitting ourselves against the truth, is changed. If you look at any of the biblical healings, a person is always changed. I underwent a serious illness, and it changed me a lot. I used to be something like a Prussian general about spiritual things, you know, stoic and hard and such like that. So, this is lent to us. We don't have to accept it if we don't want. And we can't permanently hold it for ourselves. We can give ourselves to the source of grace, but it's a loan in the same way that on the material level, the action of an herb is a loan to help us restore balance. Now, we're just about out of time. In fact, we are out of time. I'll just mention a few things without going into them in any detail at all. It's clear that what are called the sins of commission and omission are tied up with this. The sins of commission are martial. We do things that we shouldn't do. We're passionate people. The sins of omission are satanic or are demonic. We hold back from doing things that should be done. And so the hyper and hypo conditions are indicated by planets that either stimulate or overstimulate or that damp our attitudes and do so severely. It isn't just those two planets, those are the most simple and obvious examples. There are whole families of planets that tend to be overstimulating. And there are families of planets that tend to be blocking and tend to hold things back. One last little thing I want to talk about, and that is one note or one attitude that is of overall importance. And that is called the keynote. It is the keynote, you might say that it is the fundamental to the archetype of our entire life. It has a location at where the spine enters the brain. Corresponding to the cerebrospinal nervous system is the spinal fire, which enters the cranium and illuminates it with an inner life. And that has something like a flicker, or something almost like a fluorescent lamp. And that has an attitude. Each person, even if you listen to the music they write or even the music they play, you can feel their attitude in the keynote of their being. But that keynote itself can be either sharp or flat. Now, very sensitive musicians, or by a method of trial and error, usually using something like a wave generator or a violin where you can get to fine gradations, you can find the exact keynote of a person. And you can tell it either by hearing it with an inner ear, or you can tell it by responses to pitches. And if that keynote is radiated to the person in a smooth, regular, harmonic way, it is very healing and it is very restorative. If it is done in a jarring way, if it is harsh, you can kill a person. This is one of the ways that black magic functions, is by interfering with the keynote of a person's consciousness. There are people around that can hear it and know how to mess it up. But what does this mean to us in terms of being healthy within ourselves? It means there's something fundamental about our personality, our character as it is manifested here and now in this life. And this is what is meant when it is said, "To thine own self be true." If you don't have to hear it with your ears, though some people can. If you know what your character is and you are true to yourself and you act out of harmony with that understanding what you are, you strengthen yourself. If you act out of character and try to be something that you aren't, you weaken your entire being. And you decrease your ability to live well, and you decrease your ability to live long. So this is a very important thing. It just in terms of healing, getting a person to realize that they're a divine being, that they're a good being, and that there is a fundamental nature to them, and that if they can be true to themselves in that, they have taken great steps to being healed. All right, we're going to talk about some of these things more tomorrow, and even more on Friday. And so we'll just leave off thinking these two thoughts, one from Shakespeare, "To thine own self be true," and the other from the Bible, "As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he." And let's close with the Rosicrucian Student's Prayer. O God, increase our love for Thee, so that we may serve Thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in Thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. You realize that what we just did, that in focusing on that center of divinity through our own center of divinity, we have just refortified our own keynote. And every time you do that, you re-strengthen yourself.
When you're talking about sins of omission being satanic or
harmonic, is a much more descriptive way of the spirit of negation. In the Bible, there's a very good definition of Satanism that is the spirit of negation. It's when Christ is going to go into something troublesome and Peter says to him, "Don't do that." And Christ points that out as a negation by saying, "Get thee behind me, Satan." And but Ahriman has a different kind of description of it. It doesn't make any difference. The thing is to get used to the true principle. The names don't count. If you understand the principle, because otherwise you get into religious terminology, and people say, "Well, this is a better term than that term," and maybe it is in some ways, and maybe in some ways it isn't. Okay, yes.
Question. You said sins of omission, you said Marshall or whatever for sins of commission, in what planet is
Saturn?
Saturn.
Saturn. Yeah.
Sins of omission.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.